Let me ask you a quick question on that. What happened to our 120-day bill?
I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's kind of dead right now.
But I guess we better be inserting it into something.
I think inserting it would be...
Probably wise. They're backed up over in the other side.
Well, make it easier for them.
Backed up? Was that the phrase?
Their dockets have been long.
Yeah, I backed up. That's interesting.
Our next...
I'm very charitable of you, Mr. Arnold.
Actually, Representative Clark, I would say that that was the situation we're in this committee right now. I'm sure that report is going back.
Moving along quickly, Madam Chair. On page 12, lines 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, that's the section which would make first offense misdemeanors of a nonviolent character violations unless there were compelling reasons for district attorneys to file those or litigate them as crimes and thereby have court-appointed attorney costs. This is a balancing question, I'd suggest to the members of the committee, to balance your indigent defense costs over here, which I understand are very high, with what you're going to do to the statutes in the state of Oregon. And so when I review those misdemeanors, what this will do is, except in compelling cases, whatever that word compelling means, and I'm sure litigate that out, hopefully maybe establish some legislative history, but whatever that means, your standard shoplifting case on a first offense basis would no longer be a crime in the state of Oregon. False swearing on an application for court-appointed attorney. Recall, we just did sections 12 through 15 or talked about those where you would apply under oath for a court-appointed attorney. If you lie under that, under this section, you would now find that it would be a maximum penalty of a $250 fine for lying to get your court-appointed attorney.
Do we send those people to jail now, Mr. Harkleberg?
Sometimes. Sometimes not.
It speaks differently to the jail space situation than I've heard during the last 6 months.
There are a wide range of sentencing alternatives when a person is convicted of a crime. There's probation to the court. There's probation, formal probation. There's work release type programs. There are counseling type programs. All of those things are available on a misdemeanor sentence that are not available on a violation sentence. So there's a wide range of alternatives, and the judge has choices to make that he can or she can make.
Giving the judge that range of alternatives, which generally I think we could agree would not include jail, is worth the additional cost to the state of an indigent defense attorney for a first offense. That's
yes.
Your position.
Yeah, if I might continue with some additional crimes here that this would affect. Escape in the third degree, where people run off where they're not in a correctional facility, would no longer be a crime. It would be a violation, maximum fine of $250, excuse me. Failure to appear in the second degree
but Mr. Harkleberg, again, when you apprehend someone who has escaped from a facility to which they've been sentenced, they go back to the facility. They don't get to stay out because they got out. They're back in. So they're going to go back in anyway.
When they're arrested to serve the rest of their sentence, but there is no additional penalty. They would have served that had they not escaped. So there is no additional penalty for leaving that facility on the misdemeanor basis. Now, obviously, that doesn't talk about escape in the second or first degree. Tampering with a witness is another crime that would become a violation. Official misconduct in the second degree would become a violation. Unlawful legislating lobbying, which, frankly, I know of no prosecution, but I noticed that one as I was going through some of the mystery readers, would no longer be a crime. Child neglect, something that's fairly serious, which is not in the violent area, but it's an area where we need to be protecting our children. It would be a violation. Forgery in the second degree. Issuing a false financial statement would be a violation. So if you applied to get a loan for an automobile at your credit union and you lied on that application, that would be a violation. Now.
And again, just I mean, I understand there was a discussion of this, and I want you to have your the merits of that discussion on the record, because we are engaging in a balancing here. And the issue isn't whether those things are okay. That has never been the issue. The issue is whether the cost of providing indigent defense is worth the benefit of having the potential of opening up space in the local jail for these particular offenders. And I suppose we'd go further and say whether that gains the state as a policy or the community as a policy the benefit of redeeming the character of the person who has or protecting the community from the particular offense. I mean, that is the balance, Mr. Harkleroad.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I agree that that certainly is part of that balance. I think what that leaves out is the discussion about alternative sentences that are available for misdemeanor cases which are not available for crime, short of putting someone in jail. And there are a wide range of alternatives. In Lane County, we have made a great effort to do that in our community corrections planning, and I think that's the case in a number of other communities as well. And so those are alternatives short of putting somebody in jail are important alternatives to be able to sentence them to some sort, to go see Lane County Mental Health if they have some kind of a mental problem when they're a shoplifter is important to do.
I agree. And the purpose here is we would like to be able to engage in some cost saving in the indigent defense arena, which would enable us to adequately fund alternatives like community corrections and mental health. And we don't have money to fund those programs adequately now. But we have got to fund indigent defense. That is a mandate. We don't have any choice.
Let me go on here. In addition to those definition problems in this as to what is nonviolent, is menacing nonviolent? I only pose that as a question. That's in the person's crimes area. There is no violence as such, but there is threatening serious physical harm. I'd suggest that there's an area where this statute needs to be worked on so we're clear about what's in and what's out if you choose to do it. What is a first offense misdemeanor? Does that mean they have no prior record of any kind, or is it a first offense in that particular category? That's an area that needs to be clarified should you do this statute. I already mentioned what is compelling. Now, let me suggest something.
I think counsel could, Mr. Harkleroad, clarify what a...
Madam Chair, I think the members of the committee for the legislative history right now could clarify that issue.
Sure. I point that out as an issue that's for work session, I would think, if you choose to pass this. Let me suggest something else here, that this statute takes us into the violation area, and I submit most of the district attorneys, if this statute was passed, would try to make the call about whether or not it was compelling up front rather than file them as crimes and force the situation where you're going to have counsel then and incur that indigent defense cost. But it unnecessarily, in some ways, limits us. In Lane County, for example, we have a fast-track accountability program now. Sometimes it's called Arena-Rama. Sometimes it's called Let's Make a Deal. I've described it to this committee in the past, where 58% of the people that we make offers to walk into district court and plead guilty, and we make offers at that first appearance in the vast majority of the cases. It's not a program that's been going more than 9 months or a year, but it's a way that we are saving substantial sums of indigent defense. Deschutes County is trying to get that program going right now. Multnomah County has their violation program, which is a good program in that it works for them. I would note that the criteria upon which it is based is arrests, not whether or not they're first convictions or not. So I think Multnomah County would have to change the way they viewed their cases as they filed them. Maybe that's good, maybe that's bad, but it would change their program. So there are some other options, at least as evidenced by Lane County's approach to how to get around the situation of basically not wanting to treat everything as violations when people steal things, but at the same time wanting to save indigent defense costs. And I think we've been fairly effective at that.
May I inquire?
Yes.
your problem is not with the language on page 11 and where we talk about the court can ask about how the defendant, before the court asks, the district attorney can declare the intention. Your part is the mandatory language, page 12. That's your problem.
Right? Yes, precisely.
And that's why you propose these amendments. Second part of your amendments has to do with this fiscal impact. How would you feel, and you're saying we should take that language out of page 12, lines 21 through 24, how would you feel if we changed it to read, each proposed legislative measure that has an increased fiscal impact on the state indigent defense fund shall be accompanied by an indigent defense fund fiscal impact statement at the time of its consideration by any legislative committee? Would you have a problem with that?
That would be fine. What I would suggest, though, is that these lines 22, 23, and 4, they only go to the increased fiscal impact. If there is a decreased fiscal impact, it's probably important to know that as well. Not that there are a lot of bills that do that,
but calls for a change in the fiscal impact, increased or decreased. Good point. Thank you.
Yeah, because
so you wouldn't oppose it if it read each proposed legislative measure that has a fiscal impact on the state indigent defense fund
shall be accompanied by. Was Representative Mannix's language there?
Yeah, I'm playing around too, Madam Chair.
There are circumstances as well where we pass statutes into law that must have a fiscal impact on district attorney budgets in all of the counties. Does that come up as an issue?
Sure. You certainly do that. It's come up big in the mental health commitment areas. Representative Gilmore knows about that. I'd say lobbied it pretty heavy to get that money back into the budget.
Thank you.
I have a question.
That's all I have.
Any questions for Representative Minnis?
Mr. Harkle wrote, looking on page 12, line 3, the word may is there, making it discretionary on the part of the district attorney to treat particular kinds of misdemeanors as violations. I'm not an attorney, but it seems to me that there may be a problem in terms of equal protection if there is a discriminatory practice on the part of a district attorney versus one racial ethnic group over another or one particular kind of client over another. Is that a real problem, or am I off base?
Well, I'd suggest that it might be a problem in a particular case if counsel for the defense could raise some factual issues or put some proof on to show that. Okay, that would be a problem now if they had that kind of evidence. And if they had that evidence, I'd hope it would be brought forward and put on, because people shouldn't be prosecuted on that kind of a basis. The line 2 and line 3 on page 12, right up to the semicolon before however,
yes,
that language really doesn't do much, because it's already embodied in the language on the preceding page, page 11, where it switches it around and gives the district attorney to declare on the record the intention to treat it as a violation. That's already there.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Harkler, maybe I'm coming in late to this conversation, but the language on page 11 has got me confused. How does a court object? It seems to me that we've got the cart. I would never presume to. You see my point?
Yeah, I understand your point. And
who rules on the objection?
Well, nobody rules on the objection is the way I see it. If the court doesn't want it filed as a violation, then the court, in essence, has a veto power. The way it works right now.
I may just be hung up on the language about object.
Yeah, maybe so. The way it works right now is that the DA, in essence, has the veto power, and the court can declare it as a misdemeanor. As a practical matter, because the DA has a veto power, what the DA decides to do with it is controlling. Although we have some judges who think this is an unconstitutional statute, so they don't do anything with it. Now, if you switch that around and you say that the DA gets to make the initial call and the court then has the veto power, I suspect what will happen is you'll get some judges who will probably, unless they have real strong feelings about it, let that go through.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix.
Shouldn't we talk about overruling by the court rather than objection by the court?
I think that's one of my only points.
I'm going to put that in here. It seems to me we're talking about the court overruling your statements to say, I'm not going to let you do that, Mr. District Attorney, and
Yeah, it's just not, it's not an evidentiary situation, Representative Mannix.
The court doesn't object to what you do. The court just tells you you can't do it.
You might want to just, I'm just playing with language now, and I didn't draft this at all, but how about disallows? This is a thought. I would suggest that we could come up with a word that would satisfy most everybody.
Other questions? Are we thinking of the word?
Thinking of the word.
Yeah.
The word.
Well, we'll mull that over while we listen to the next witnesses. Thank you. I want to declare the intention of the chair in terms of the remainder of our schedule. We are not going to get through our agenda today, and I'm not going to pretend like we are. So people who are here on Senate Bill 512, Senate Bill 697, Senate Bill 391, House Bill 2666, and Senate Bill 247 can go home. And we will reschedule those, and council will probably want to hang me high, but that's that. Senate Bill 520 we may get to today, depending on how quickly we move on Senate Bill 284. Work session on Senate Bill 293 will be set over. And we will adjourn at...
Got any other problems?
20 minutes to 5. Ross Shepherd, do you want to testify at the same time, Bob? I have Bob Peters and Ross Shepherd. You might as well come up together.
Just take an idea. Except for that we need some of this.
Getting longer.
Go ahead.
I'm Bob Peters. I'm chair of the Oregon State Bar's Committee on Indigent Defense. And along with Mr. Shepherd and Doug Harkerode and Representative Bauman and a number of legislators and other persons involved in the criminal justice system, we've taken a serious look this year before the session and during the session at ways that we can keep an eye on cost effectiveness in this system. The bar has been working on this for a long time. We pre-introduced 10 bills, and one of those bills is essentially here. This is the contribution bill to allow the indigent person who can make some contribution to do so. We think that's essential. We think it's a matter of integrity in terms of the individual himself. While in a sense it does skin our shins a little to have our clients have to make that extra effort, maybe some problem, we think that's important. We think the verification of indigency preserves the integrity of the system. There's some people who are always concerned that people are getting something for free who can afford to pay for it. We believe that this is a way of safeguarding against that lack of confidence. We believe that the first time treatment of misdemeanors as violations is a wise policy decision. I would just call you back to Doug Harkerwood's comment. It's very unlikely that a person would be escaping on a first-time misdemeanor. That almost presupposes that person's in custody for something. Same is true of a failure to appear. You're not likely to be prosecuted for a failure to appear because that presupposes there's been something already in the works. This is first-time offenses, and this is essentially a kind of diversion that's not a complete diversion out of the system. It puts a tax on the person who's committed the crime, requires them to pay something to make this system work, and there is a substantial fine available.
And thank you. Shouldn't we really make this discretionary, though, and just say that the district attorney may and see how it works for a couple of years before we jump into making it mandatory, get into arguments about whether or not this was a nonviolent or a violent crime and so on and so forth?
This flows out of a history where there already is wide discretion for the district attorneys to use a diversion program. There are several diversion programs. They are almost never used, certainly in Lane County. I think you would just be very hard-pressed to find five cases in the last 5 years of that sort. They just don't use them. And I think this is the problem, where they are totally optional.
What if we switch it around and say that it will be a violation unless the attorney advises the court otherwise?
That's what we're basically saying, that a first offense will be a violation unless, and this is important, there may be some unique circumstance where the DA can persuade the court this ought to be treated more seriously. And so
you're talking to a hardcore group here. Maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but a lot of us have been trying to turn up the juice, not turn down the juice.
We understand that. But you're also looking at ways to finance this whole criminal justice system, right? And you've turned up the juice, and it's going to cost a lot of money. What we've been looking at is ways of costing less money, saving some money. And this is a way that we believe some money can be saved. Now, you need to realize we're all giving up something on this. The DAs, the defense lawyers, Oregon State Bar, this is not... We don't just come in with bells and say, this is the greatest thing since cottage cheese or something. The real problems for all of us with this. We think this is a package that provides a vehicle for cost saving, and we think it's a very important opportunity for the legislature to do something to show the people of the state of Oregon that we want as trim and slim and effective a system as we can possibly have, and that's why we've participated in this. I think I would agree with those who preceded me on the post-conviction relief. If we would limit to 120 days the time for filing, it would be much more effective. But I would call to your attention, the main issue here is the issue of adequacy of counsel. That's what comes up almost always. And that will be dreamed up by somebody four or five years later who's sitting out at Pendleton or someplace, and he remembers something that might have happened. And the record is way back. It takes a lot of time to revive it. And there is more cost in doing that.
Let me take you back a step, though. You said that this is something where everybody is giving a little bit, but it doesn't sound like anybody asked the Oregon District Attorneys Association if they would like to give up this little goodie.
Not at all. They were involved in these deliberations.
They just didn't agree to it.
Well, we all have parts of this that we're more enthusiastic about than others.
Well, what if we give you back post-conviction relief for 120 days, and we'll give them back the option
to
be able to
Well, actually, that's a possibility. Representative Mannix and hot fudge Sunday diets are always real popular with dieters, too, and what we could do is give everyone indigent defense counsel, have more community corrections, and have more jail space more programs. And
I'll
Mr.
pay for that, too.
Excuse me, Representative Gilmore is here taking
too.
Notes so that he can go downstairs and fund these programs for us, and we really appreciate you doing that.
You forgot one item on your list.
I'm sorry.
And that was the increased per hourly rate.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
right.
maybe Representative Gilmore can address the status of that bill. I'm curious.
Which one?
The hourly rate.
Oh, I've said on the record I personally would increase it to $100 if I had a choice. But there's a caveat, obviously.
We heard today, Representative Gilmore, before you arrived, from attorneys who were earning $500 an hour on preparation for certain cases. I'm sorry, medical experts.
Yeah. Could just reduce the caseload by 1/10, take care of the problem.
The ones that really go to jail.
Are the ones that should go to jail.
Okay.
Where's the difference?
Thank you. Are there other questions? Would you like to continue, Mr. Shepherd?
My name is Ross Shepherd. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I view this bill as the culmination of more than 2 years of work that my organization has put in, along with legislators, prosecutors, judges, everybody involved with the criminal justice system. And it's been made abundantly clear to us that there needs to be cost containment in indigent defense, and I suggest to you that this bill could be so denominated. It draws from various suggestions that all of the different players came up with, and except for one possible revision, we support each part of it. The revision that I'd suggest to you would adopt Representative Baum's notion concerning post-conviction relief with the 120-day limitation, and I would suggest to you some additional language that perhaps his bill has that would allow filings outside of the 120 days if extraordinary circumstances could be shown. I'll recite to you, a hypothetical case. If it were shown after perhaps 3 years after conviction that the defense attorney had been paid by the prosecutor to get the defendant convicted, that defendant should have a remedy to be able to get that conviction off his record. And if we were to do away entirely with post-conviction relief or not allow filing after 120 days under any circumstances, that person would have no remedy. The person could sue under the Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 1983, for money, but the conviction would remain. So I'm suggesting to you a 120-day limit in essentially all cases, but there be an escape valve for the extraordinary cases. The two controversial portions of this bill are the reductions of misdemeanors to violations. I suggest to you that we have two jurisdictions that are running pretty well under the circumstances, including yours, Representative Gilmore, where this is happening. And these are still viable political entities. They're going on with their life. And there's no reason why it can't be implemented in the rest of the state. And in 2 years, if somehow or another failure, which I see no reason why it should be, this body then could change that. You have two models, though, two successful models. They are saving quite a bit of money in Marion and Multnomah County. If we're implemented statewide, this is a very real cost savings in the indigent defense realm.
Representative Clark.
Successful models.
Yes.
Successful how?
They're successful in that the cases are processed without apparent injustice and with palpable savings.
Injustice to who, though?
Well, to us as the citizens. And there's no injustice on the accused, the accused defendant either.
Representative Minnis.
But Mr. Shepherd, where's all this information you keep referring to about these successful models and how much money they save? I haven't got Jack Diddley in front of me that shows me that they're saving anything.
Well,
I'm a little bit miffed over this whole process. You sit here telling us, talking about the A2 amendments and talking about players and the people that put this stuff together, yet I'm a committee member and I didn't see this doggone thing until this afternoon when I came to committee, and that really irritates me. And we're talking about an issue that's very critical to this state and a significant fiscal impact, and I'm sitting in this committee listening to something that occurred somewhere else. And I frankly don't like it. I think this is a doggone serious subject.
Let me interrupt. Representative Minnis, that is none of the account, I don't believe, of...
Well, I don't know whose account it is. I'd like to know.
I will accept that. And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, that you didn't see the amendments until this session today. Representative Mannix.
Well, I may not agree with all of the amendments, I don't consider it any different than any of the other work groups who informally put things together. I don't feel bound by anything anybody comes in here with anyway, and I intend to look at it freshly and review it from that perspective. But we've had many a work group try to put together compromise packages. I don't take particular offense at that.
I appreciate that, and I will join with Representative Minister's frustration that Multnomah County and Marion County are not here today to support the workings of their own internal systems in terms of those systems offering some benefit to state policy. Representative Clark.
With all respect, I have to at least ask the question whether, I mean, Multnomah County and Marion County, I think, also have some of the highest crime rates in the state. And I'm not going to sit here and try and make a connection between the one and the other, but I at least have to ask that question about treating misdemeanors as violations, and what does that do, and what messages does that send? All those questions are ones that are coming up in my mind, and I don't have the information I need to.
Maybe Mr. Linden can answer the question of whether crime rates are high in Multnomah County because the DA treats misdemeanors as violations. Could you come up?
I mean, Madam Chair, to state the question is almost to answer it, but just in terms of the policy, it is. I mean, I recognize it seems to me is. It's an admission of system failure, and we're doing that lots of places in the system. In some ways, sentencing guidelines is that. It's at least an admission of system capacity, and I mean those are the questions that are quite honestly running around my mind, Mr. Linden.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I know that in Multnomah County, the district attorney there has made a conscious decision that certain types of misdemeanor cases will be handled as violations, and I think it's done in recognition of at least two realities. One is because of the local correctional facility problems in that county, he has a good idea what types of misdemeanors, if convicted, are going to do any significant, appreciable, or for that matter, any time in the county facility. And secondly, I do think that, that the district attorney there has an appreciation for the total system costs involved in processing a misdemeanor case through for his office, for the defense bar, and for the courts, if in fact the sanction at the end is going to be relatively meaningless. I know that in a meeting on this matter last week that John Bradley, the chief deputy attorney in Multnomah County, attended. He indicated that their misdemeanor to violation treatment is successful in the sense of what they wanted it to do, which was to treat more realistically those offenders who weren't going to do anything significant in terms of jail time, and it does save us money up there. It winnows cases out of the system that otherwise we'd be spending trial counsel time on. In Marion County, I think District Attorney Penn has a similar philosophy about it, which is to let's be realistic about what, you know, what types of misdemeanors are actually going to do any appreciable amount of jail time, and he actively reduces cases violations as well. But I think those two counties are the exception.
Can you make some estimate, we didn't ask you this when you were up before, what the cost savings